Good evening and welcome. I'm Ava Raspini, and I'm an assistant curator in the Department of Photography here at the Museum of Modern Art. And it is my great pleasure and great honor to be here tonight to moderate this panel discussion and to introduce our esteemed guests, Dennis Hopper, Katie Grannon, and Annie Prue. Tonight's panel is being hosted in conjunction with the exhibition Into the Sunset, Photography's Image of the American West, which is currently on view in the museum's third floor galleries. I would like to extend my gratitude to Edgar and Sue Wackenheim for their generous and partial support of this exhibition. Before we begin, I'd just like to say a few words about the format for this evening. I will give a brief overview of the exhibition, and then I will introduce each of our panelists. Each panelist will make a short presentation about their work, which will be followed by moderated discussion at the table here. And if time permits, we will end the evening with a few questions from the audience. The American West is a big place, not just in terms of square mileage, but also in how large it looms in the public imagination. The historian Clyde Milner has said that the West was an idea that became a place. Photography, with its ability to construct persuasive and seductive narratives, has been the ultimate vehicle for creating and perpetuating that idea. This exhibition explores how the medium of photography has established, shaped, and transformed the image of the American West over the past 150 years. This exhibition is also about a parallel relationship. The settlement of the West by European Americans in the mid-19th century coincided with the advent of photography. The West's seemingly infinite bounty and endless potential symbolized America as a whole. This is where the country's future would unfold, and the new technology of photography was the perfect medium with which to forge a national identity. And this complex association between the two continues to this day. The exhibition is organized in thematic sections where works from the 19th, 20th, and 21st century hang side by side. I will touch tonight on just a few of examples of themes and pictures included here. Grand depictions of the West as a paradise or Eden were seen in many 19th century photographs, including the expansive pictures made by Carlton Watkins in Yosemite Valley in 1865 and 66, like this grand triptych here. Included in the exhibition are also images of the settled land, such as this 1869 picture celebrating the Transcontinental Railway made by Andrew Russell, and pictures made after the advent of the interstate highway system, such as Edward Weston's 1937 photograph of a roadside sign in the Mojave Desert, are also included in the exhibition. The construction of suburban communities and suburban sprawl became a rich subject matter for photographers such as Robert Adams, who photographed new suburban developments in Colorado in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And Joel Sternfeld explored the suburban lifestyle in the 1970s and 80s. Western archetypes make up many of the pictures of people in the exhibition, such as this portrait of a gold miner taken in the 1850s, as well as this photograph by Gertrude Kazebeer of a Sioux cast member of the Buffalo Bill Wild West Traveling Show. Some of the most well-known gangs of the West are represented, including several members of the Hells Angels motorcycle gang, who posed for Irving Penn in 1967 in San Francisco. The cowboy, of course, is one of the West's most mythic characters, and a version is seen in Richard Prince's re-photographed Marlboro advertisement. And finally, the psychology of the failed promise is seen in pictures such as Dorothea Lange's seminal and iconic 1936 picture, Migrant Mother, of a destitute mother of seven, which served as a poster image for the New Deal. Of course, the West has also been mythologized in film and literature, and I hope that tonight's panel will expand the dialogue beyond the gallery walls. In conjunction with the exhibition Into the Sunset, a series of exhibitions in the museum's theaters presents films linked to cinema's century-long preoccupation with the West. The film exhibition is organized by Raj Roy, chief curator in the Department of Film, and Anne Mora, assistant curator in that same department. Some of the films that will be screened include the 1944 film Buffalo Bill, Annie Get Your Gun, and as well as Andy Warhol's 1965 film Horace, which is an outrageous departure on the traditional Western. In addition, on May 31st, in conjunction with Pop Rally, we will host an exclusive preview of a documentary film directed by Meredith Danluck that uses the professional bull riders circuit as a jumping-off point for the world into the modern cowboy. You can purchase tickets for all of these associated programs on MoMA's website, MoMA.org. And so now I will briefly introduce each of our panelists who really need no introduction. Katie Grannon received her BA from the University of Pennsylvania and her MFA from Yale, and she's been making resonant portraits of a variety of individuals in a number of locations, from the Mystic Lake near her hometown in Massachusetts to the San Francisco Bay Area, which she now calls home. This 2006 picture, titled Nicole Crissy Field, is currently on view in the exhibition Into the Sunset. It's from a recent body of work titled The Westerns, which Grannon began after moving to California a few years ago. Grannon met Nicole several years ago and has been photographing her ever since. She is an ever-changing character who poses for the artist in a number of guises. The artist describes her subjects as, quote, new pioneers, Northern Californians who struggle to define themselves under the scrutiny of the relentless sunlight. In her work, California serves as a literal and a metaphorical backdrop, a mythical destination, as well as a real endpoint for both the joyful and the abject. Dennis Hopper is an artist passionately engaged in a variety of disciplines, which includes photography, painting, acting, directing, and writing. This iconic photograph, made in 1961, is titled Double Standard and is currently on view in the exhibition, and shows Hopper's fascination with the Southern California landscape of outdoor advertising. Hopper began his career as a painter, but after a fire that destroyed most of his work in 1961, he took up photography. His photographs include portraits of some of the most noted artists, curators, and dealers in the field, and tell a remarkable history of the California art world. In 1969, Hopper co-wrote, directed, and starred in Easy Rider, the seminal countercultural classic that defined road movies for generations to come. Another directorial effort includes the 1988 film Colors that, in my mind, speaks to the legends of the gangs and outlaws of the West. He's also known for many of his award-winning roles, which include performances in Blue Velvet, among many, many others. Annie Proulx is a noted author, scholar, and journalist who has written a number of stories set against the backdrop of the American West, and she has also written very beautifully on photography and art. She has lived for a number of years in Wyoming, where many of her stories take place, but she's also lived in rural Vermont and Newfoundland. She has received a number of awards for her writing, including the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and the National Book Award for her second novel, The Shipping News. Her short story, Brokeback Mountain, which first appeared in The New Yorker, was adapted as an award-winning major motion picture, which was released in 2005. She also won the Faulkner Award for Fiction for her first novel, Postcards. Proulx's fiction reflects what she finds most interesting, and her characters are flawed, lonely, and burdened. Her landscapes are remote places that are extremely vivid and personal. For me, in her writing, the West, or certain parts of it, is a place that comes alive through its description of the land. And it's not just a backdrop for her narratives, but a larger-than-life character. So now I would like to hand over the mic to each one of our panelists, beginning with Katie Grannon. Thank you.
Move back here. Okay. As Ava said, I moved to the West Coast about 5 years ago, but before that I spent most of my life in the Northeast. And this is a photograph I made at Mystic Lake near my parents' home in Massachusetts. At the time, I worked with a 4x5 camera on a tripod, and I stood up on a small stepladder. And while the two of us were making this photograph, a passerby called the police to report that she had witnessed some unusual activity in the park, and she was really nervous and upset by it. And the police arrived, and we were quickly escorted from the park. And I mention this only because it was pretty typical, actually, of my experience in New England. And although we were simply making a photograph, the appearance of the whole thing was unfamiliar, and this was apparently forbidden. So my photo shoots were often secretive, you know, made behind bushes and indoors when no one was home, since family and friends would have disapproved. One of my favorite subjects was Valerie. At the time that we met, I had really no idea how much our conversations and her experience later would foreshadow the work that I'm making today in California. Valerie lived at home with her mom in Ghent, and she was a really unlikely figure in upstate New York in this small town. It's really hard to see from the projection here, but she had stars tattooed all over her forehead and little teardrop tattoos under both her eyes. And she was clearly restless and eager to move out of her mom's house and away from this small town. And she posed in her mom's prom gown and held a little bird that kept pecking at her hand while she tried to stand still for the picture. But she was really excited. She kept telling me all about her plans to move west. And she said she was going to move to Southern California. Her plan was to become a tattoo artist or a rock star, she said. And at that moment, everything seemed possible to her. She was certain that her life would be better once she moved west. About 1 year later, Valerie called me again to say she was back in New York. She said that California was nothing like she thought it would be. She wasn't able to find a job, and she had been robbed by people she thought were her friends. So she returned home to New York and asked if I would come photograph her again. And despite the recent failure of her move to California, Valerie was upbeat. There was a kind of a sweet optimism in her wanting to be photographed and to be paid some attention. And I wondered whether posing for a photograph was proof for her that escape was still possible, if only for the duration of the shoot. And when my family decided to move to California, we went there really for the same reason that so many people have moved west. There was an opportunity for us and a chance for something different. But when we arrived, what struck me immediately was that the sunlight was relentless and actually kind of cruel. There was no hiding from it. The first photographs I made were drenched in this bright, harsh sunlight reflecting the California landscape and people that I, like Ava said, refer to as new pioneers. And I often think about aspects of photography as cruel because a photograph is capable of a kind of scrutiny that we're not subjected to in real life. And in pictures, we reveal things unintentionally that become immovable and fixed in the resulting image. But I usually find these revelations comforting as evidence of how we really are. And I started a project that I'm still working on called The Westerns, and it's sort of divided up into different chapters. Up until the time I met Gail, pictured here, I had been photographing strangers that I'd meet often for the first and last time. This was our first day photographing together, and this is exactly how Gail reacted to the camera. It's hard to see the detail up here, but she had such a generous, exuberant spirit, almost like a child, and she was so uninhibited and joyful. Gail personified a lot of what I'd been interested in for a long time. She has a really wonderful imagination, and she's radically reinvented herself to the extent that she regards her clothing as costume and much of her life actually is a kind of theater. And Gail's not crazy. She's highly intelligent, and I think she's smarter than most people, actually. At least she's a lot more brave. With my earlier work, the act of making a photograph itself was a kind of theater. The circumstances were artificial and improvised, and what emerged was a hybrid sort of between something real and imagined. But now the idea of theater and transformation wasn't limited to the act of making a photograph, but it included the way that my subjects constructed identities and recast themselves within the context of a mythical West. And Gail and her best friend, Dale, also in this photograph, have a really romantic sensibility. And so I wanted the photographs to reflect this. But the Western, you know, the sun doesn't discriminate between aspiration and failure. It illuminates both equally. And so it was important that my photographs include this sort of this collision between fantasy and reality of the place, the moments when the myth unravels a little bit. So as beautiful as I tried to make these pictures in particular, I didn't want them to be easy. I didn't want them to just be fairy tales. Thomas Mann once spoke of something he called erotic irony, which means loving the thing or person you're hurting with your harsh analysis. And so I wanted these photographs to be respectful of Gail and Dale because they're really almost heroic figures to me. But it was also important to describe a fragile psychology and the tension that exists in all portraits, that, you know, the tension between how we imagine we appear and how we're actually seen. The Pacific Coast is impossibly beautiful at times, but it's also a psychological endpoint. And I think that many of us who find ourselves there understand the limits of the myth and the idea of the West. And instead, what we're faced with, you know, is ourselves, our own potential and limitations. Wallace Stegner observed that there is, in fact, no West, but there are many Wests and certainly many different experiences of the place. I met another woman one morning in downtown San Francisco, and she was kind of ambiguous. I couldn't tell at the time if she was a man or a woman, whether she was starting her day or ending her night. There was something imprecise and unclear about her, and I was really intrigued. I asked her if we could work together, and this is the first day that we worked together. And that first day, as soon as we got to the beach, she just immediately took all her clothes off. It wasn't a nude beach. She just paraded naked through a family that was also at the beach, there to make a photograph as well. They were all kind of standing together wearing khaki pants and matching white shirts, and they were probably, I don't know, posing for their annual Christmas card or something, but she just marched right through the group of them and continued on down the beach. And that pretty much sums up the 4 years what the 4 years of our working together has been like. It's been completely unpredictable and wonderful. And I photographed on a lot of beaches in California, and I couldn't help but think of Edward Weston's, you know, stunning nudes in Carmel, but how that kind of picture and that kind of woman really seems no longer possible. While there's still, you know, plenty of idealism in California, it's of course a far more complex and fallible place than that. And Nicole, just like Gallandale, loved being photographed, and she did this with an exaggerated theatricality, but with Nicole, there was always a violence to it, as though she were simultaneously trying to invent and destroy herself. She's a mercurial personality, and I wanted the pictures to really reflect this and to confuse the theater and authenticity. And although she could be pretty challenging, and you know, I mean that in the best sense, she really made the pictures more interesting. One day I asked her if we could try something kind of natural. She used to like to get really sort of dolled up, and I asked if she would just not wear any makeup and if she would be natural and we would just make that kind of photograph. And so I set up, we went to a place called Chrissy Field, and I set up the camera in the parking lot while she got ready in the car. And finally she emerged. And this is how she appeared. This was her answer to me, and she didn't want my suggestions. She had drawn eyeliner all over her face and down her neck. I don't know how clearly you can see it, but it was a really kind of dramatic and unsettling gesture that basically, you know, said, "Fuck you, Katie. This is who I'm going to be today." And she was part Norma Desmond, part Marilyn Monroe, but at the same time, the guise was aggressively rejected and undone. It's probably safe to characterize part of the Western experience as searching and restless and even unstable, and Nicole personifies this description, I think. And though I know her really well now, she's still a slippery personality, almost like a phantom. She's always changing her appearance pretty drastically. She gains and loses weight. She changes her hair color. So just when I think I know her, she's almost become someone else. And for a period of time, I photographed her once a week. I'd show up every Thursday and photograph her in the same corner of her bedroom. I wanted to see how she appeared that day. And of course, she knew I was showing up to photograph her. And as usual, she presented a slightly different version of herself every time. And it might seem like an unnecessary point to make, but I'll make it since I still think there's a persistent belief, maybe a subconscious one or something, that when you picture a real person or when you photograph in the world, then you've described a truthful story. And this is a kind of storytelling, but it's certainly not a document of Nicole or of Gail and Dale. That doesn't interest me at all. We were improvising and collaborating in a loose, unscripted way, although what was real and what was invented were constantly overlapping and indiscernible. And finally, I'll share just a few photographs from work that I've begun in Los Angeles. And it's just another chapter in the Westerns. It's sort of my version of street photography. And I know it's a cliche to say that nobody walks in LA, but really it's kind of shocking how few people are actually walking around anywhere. And those who are walking, at least in West Hollywood, where I've been working, are really extraordinary. And I suspect a lot of people move there to be part of the entertainment industry, to be seen, you know, or discovered. But of course, it doesn't usually happen. And I wanted to photograph people who'd been rendered invisible, and they might be industry casualties, anonymous, but no matter what their circumstances are, they're still subjected to that relentless light. They're the ones that most everyone else is passing by in their cars, maybe catching a curious glimpse of them for a second or two and driving on. So I've been walking around approaching the few people I see, and if they agree, we make a photograph together on the spot, and they appear exactly as I've met them. And it never takes us long to find a sunny spot in that ubiquitous white stucco wall in West Hollywood. There's probably no better place for this kind of street theater than in LA. The people that I approach are usually really enthusiastic about being photographed, and they're really generous. They'll spend an hour, sometimes an entire afternoon, hanging out with me, working with me and telling me about themselves and where they came from and what's happened to them in the city. I've always been attracted to a peculiar kind of optimism and exuberance, and it's something that one that's exaggerated and sort of capable of altering the way that we perceive and experience the world. And I think a photograph can exist as tangible proof of this, like it did for Valerie. It can be a kind of evidence. It's evidence of I think, a need to feel visible or to feel valued. And maybe it's an escape from what Tony Kushner once described as an unbearable ordinariness. But the escape in the theater involved in making a photograph is short-lived, and the moment passes and everything goes back to the way it was. So perhaps the one thing that is truly invented here that exists as a brand new story and a distinctly new reality is the photograph itself.
Hi, I'm Dennis Hopper. I was born in 1936. I saw that photograph of Dorothea Lange that she'd made of the frontierswoman, 1936. That's the year I was born. I was born in Dodge City, Kansas, in the middle of a dust storm. And my mother was in labor for 72 hours. She never forgave me for that. And it was, I had a very wonderful childhood. But I lived in Dodge City until I was 9 years old, and then my father came back from the Second World War, and he was in the Office of Strategic Services. And then we moved to Kansas City, Missouri, and I lived there till I was 13. And then we moved to San Diego, California. I started acting at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego and doing Shakespeare, and that's where I got my acting training. I went under contract to Warner Brothers when I was 18 years old, and people said, well, how, you know, this crossover thing, how do you cross over from this? I don't know what crossover from what to what, you know. I was in high school. I painted in high school. I took photographs in high school, you know, and I sit around my golf club, and everybody says, where'd you go to school? And I said, well, I went to Harvard. I went to Yale. I went to Princeton. So on. Where'd you go to school? I said, Warner Brothers. Yeah. So I went under contract when I was 18. And I made a film called Rebel Without a Cause with James Dean, and then one called Giant. And James Dean died, and I got in a lot of trouble trying to improvise and trying to do things that he had done, but I wasn't a star. So I ended up coming back to New York and studying. And I studied with Lee Strasberg here for 5 years. And during that period of time, I went to the Museum of Modern Art every day, and I walked through the permanent collection, starting with the Cezanne bathers all the way through, seeing Cezanne leaving the lines and leaving the bare canvas, and then going to the next room and seeing Matisse had expanded that, and there was more raw canvas, more lines, and going on into Cubism, and follow it all the way through. And that's where I learned about art. You know, I was a young man. So at 1961, when I'm 25 years old, I am finally given a camera by my now ex-wife, Brooke Hayward. She gave me a Nikon. And I'd taken pictures occasionally, but I'd never owned a camera of my own. James Dean, at one point, I had an old Graflex, and he said, don't crop your photographs because someday you're going to want to direct movies, and you can't crop film. Yeah. So I've never cropped any of my photographs. I shot them all full negative. So this photograph, which is now in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art, which really, I can't tell you what that means to me, but maybe at the end of this you'll figure it out. But I took this in 1961. So this is when I first got my camera. This is in Los Angeles. It's at Doheny, Santa Monica, and Melrose. Now, this separates out this way, and when it gets to La Cienega, there's about five blocks there. We used to shut down the street on Monday nights and have an art walk. And that's where Andy Warhol had his first showing of soup can paintings. It wasn't in New York. It was on La Cienega, right down this street. So this is double standard. I call it double standard. Smart women cook with gas. And I shot this in 1961. In 1964, Ed Richet and Irving Blum used this as his announcement for his standard station paintings. I got to New York, and I was in the Museum of Modern Art. And coming out onto the street, there was this thing came up out of the street right in front of the Museum of Modern Art. I don't know what you call those things, elevators, I guess. They come up on the street, and there was a bundle there with a rope on it and this splattered paint. And I went, wow, that's incredible. So I tried to frame it from the top, and I went, that's not going to work. I thought, the only way you can take this picture is to lay down in the gutter. I thought, this is crazy. People are going to look at you and think you're really nuts. Well, you're going to make this, challenge or not? So I just said, screw it. And I laid down, and I took that picture right outside the front door of the Museum of Modern Art. Anyway, thought I'd show you that. So that was a 61. This is one of my mentors. And now I met Walter Hobbs in 1956. James Dean and I went to a reading, a place called Stone Brothers Printers, which Walter Hobbs, Ed Keenholz, Wallace Berman, George Herms, and Bob Alexander had this. They made mailers and printed things out. And there was Jimmy had this, old Chinese man who dressed in an American Confederate outfit on Hollywood Boulevard. And he did Shakespeare. He did Shakespearean readings and he put a hat, for money on the street. He had the worst accent you've ever heard. He'd do these great soliloquies and so on. But Jimmy loved him. So he was doing a poetry reading at Stone Brothers Printers. So I met all the guys. I met Walter Hobbs. I met Ed Keenholz. I met Wallace Berman. I met George Herms. I met Bob Alexander. They were the guys that were Stone Brothers Printers. And Jimmy Dean died that year, unfortunately. And I stayed with this group. So in 1956 on, I was hanging out with this group. Oh, also, I don't want to leave out Dean Stockwell. Dean Stockwell, my dear friend, who's making incredible collages right now. But he was also part of that group. He was the one that bailed Wallace Berman out of jail when they busted him for pornography and tore up all of his pieces and threw him out in the alley, the LAPD. But anyway, we were making a thing with Bruce Conner called Breakaway with Tony Basil. And that's Tony Basil. One of those is Tony Basil's hands. One is Bruce Conner and the plastic egg. It was over the merry-go-round in Santa Monica. Okay, so this is Irving Blum. Now, it's now 1962. This is taken a little later. I think this is taken in 64, but it's 62. And we're all third-generation abstract expressionists, we're coming out of abstract expressionism, but that's what we are. And everybody's talking about the return to the reality. What is the return to reality going to be? They started looking at the Bay Area figurative painters, Nathan Oliveira, David Parks, Richard Diebenkorn, and they were doing some wonderful paintings, but I thought, but man, that's not a return to reality. That Soutine did that before America went totally abstract. So they're just using abstract expressionist terms and going back into the figure. That's already been done. So I walked into Irving's gallery. It was 1962. And Irving said, Dennis, I want to show you something. It's the Ferris Gallery that he and Irving Blum had started, that Walter Hobson and he had started together. And he showed me two slides. One was of a soup can, and one was of a cartoon. And I went nuts. I started jumping up and down. I said, that's it, that's it, that's it. And he said, that's what? I said, that's the return to reality that everybody's been, you know, talking about. He said, you really think so? And I said, absolutely. He said, well, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, nothing. Being an actor, nothing. And he said, well, how'd you like to go to New York? So we went to New York. And in New York, 1962, I met, and then Irving, then Andy came back and had his first soup can show at the 32 varieties of Campbell soup at the Ferris Gallery. So I met, well, this is Bruce Conner back with Terry Garr, Fran, Tony Basil, Karen, Fran, Tony Basil, and that's Ann Marshall, Terry Garr, Tony Basil, Bruce Conner. Bruce was a big influence in my life. This is a thing I took in 1963, Los Angeles Times final. And this is Ed Richey. Lynn Fulks, another one of the very early assemblage artists in California. This is Ron Davis. These are all my friends in the early 60s. This is Bob Irwin, who did the Getty Gardens. Started working with light, space. This is the first day that David Hockney was in New York. I was doing a Naked City, or the Defenders, one of them up in Harlem, and they came up to visit me, and it was the first day that David had been here. That's Andy Warhol, Henry Gelzeller, David Hockney, and Jeff Goodman. The same group. I think Andy's going to light Henry's hair. This is a picture I took of Andy. We're having lunch one day here with Barbara Rose. That's Andy Warhol, Jack Smith, Barbara. Okay. Anyway, they're making a little film at the factory. And this is Andy Warhol, Gregory Markopoulos, Taylor Mead, Gerald Malanga, Jack Smith, and they never introduced me to the girls. And this is Roy. This is Reichenberg. Oldenburg had made all these cakes for this wedding, and Oldenburg stamped Reichenberg's tongue with, this is the property of Klaus Oldenburg. This is Jasper Johns on my porch in California. And I took James Rosenquist down to the Billboard, Foster and Kleiser, because, California is billboards and cars and car culture and so on. So I was always infatuated with the billboards and the billboard company. These when they were painting everything was painted oil paintings, and it's all digital now. But it was Rosenquist at Foster and Kleiser in Los Angeles, the billboard company. And this is Klaus with his cakes that he stamped to Reichenberg. And this is a woman named Virginia Dwan Kondratieff, and she was very important also in Los Angeles in our education because she was a wealthy woman, and she had really dedicated to art. I mean, she was incredible. She brought out all the new French realists, Niki de Saint-Phalle, Jean Tingley, Yves Klein, Armand, Marcel Reiss, and gave us a whole another thing. And then Keenhole started showing with her, and then Talbot and a bunch of people from California. She was at the Duongar. And this is Nikki de Saint Phalle and Jean Tingley. Jean Tingley and Nikki were living together, and they had a studio down in Venice, California. They were showing at the Duongar. You can see it's De Gaulle, Kennedy, and Khrushchev. Yeah. Nikki de Saint Phalle. This is Marcel Reyes, who was really a dear friend of mine at that time. We were both assembling objects with photographs. Nobody had ever done it, but I couldn't show with the painters, and I was really pissed about that. So I started doing large photographs and assembling objects with him. And we opened the same night. He opened in Westwood, and he was doing the same thing, except he was still painting his photographs, but he was using large photographs as the background, painting them and assembling objects on them. So he came and looked at my show, and he says, "Wow, this looks very French." And I went and looked at his and said, "It looks very American." But it's an interesting time. And this is John Weber. John Weber worked for Virginia Duan-Kondratieff and then later got very involved in the conceptual artists and came to New York. And this is another very important person at this time. This is Robert Fraser, and Robert Fraser had a gallery in London. And so in 1966, we got a group together and we had a big show of the artists in Los Angeles, Larry Bell, Kenny Price, Jess, Bruce Conner, Ed Roche, myself. So in 1966, that was the first time any of us had ever been introduced to Europe at all. The people in New York had a lot easier time, but he was very important to us. And this is Alan Caprow. We built a bunch of ice houses for the Pasadena Museum. We built these big rectangular things and left them to melt with big kegs of ice and left them to melt and then threw flares in so they would glow at night. They melted eventually. And this is just a photograph that I like that I think is really very, very American, but at the same time, there's something about it. This is in Two Bunch Palms down in Palm Springs. But I figure you can put them in any costume. You can put a ruffle around his neck or whatever, and they would fit in almost any period of time. And they have that strange, distant stare of like eternity to me. There's something, anyway, that's why I like that. And I think that was it. Yeah. Anyway. So needless to say, the Museum of Modern Art has been very, very important in my life since it's the only education I ever really had on art besides the friends that I met. And I never got a grant, never went to a university, so it's still possible. Thank you.
I have no images. Sorry about that. But I have some pieces of history. I'm going to talk a little bit about the West. It's impossible to talk about writing in the West without a little more fodder on the West itself. The idea of a general, undifferentiated frontier region called the West belongs really to the 19th century, when that phrase was a catch-all reference that highlighted exploitable resources, free land, forests crammed with huge trees, wild peltries, and precious metals. West of the Mississippi or Missouri, wherever you take your measure. There were obstacles, including deserts, Indians, predators, but it was understood that you had to fight for the prize. Exploration, settlement, history, the grid of state borders have metamorphosed this early West into many radically different Wests. And yet, the myth of a homogeneous beyond the Missouri West persists to this day. American public perception does not want complex, diversely charactered regional Wests, but a simple and satisfying nutshell description. The result is the myth of the West as a beautiful, rugged place populated by cowboys, ranchers, tough people, a West of adobe, wild horses, chili and cactus where you can have a second chance. Photography and literature and film have supported the myth rather than the reality. The myth, in fact, is realer than the reality. As Dan Flores says in Caprock Canyonlands, mythology makes ordinary places the scenes of great events, thus giving them extraordinary power. If the West you want to believe in is that old West where men wore cowboy boots, holstered guns, big hats, and vests, then Wyoming is a living model of the 19th century cowboy way. Conservative, white, racist, homophobic male society that spends a lot of time outdoors and relegates women to a secondary place. Physical ability, endurance, and hard work are the prized virtues. But in the real world, the subregions of today's West and the radically different characters of the various states and ethnic groups is what colors day-to-day life on the ground. Various historians, the new West historians, have come up with a list of characteristics that define the West. What's interesting is that the West is everywhere in the world. And some of these characteristics are raising livestock, aridity and irrigation, the place as a plundered province, a hatred of government, ethnic diversity and ethnic rigidity, hinterland status, romantic frontier, natural geologic wonders, historic territorial status, large federal land ownership, a place beyond the 100th meridian, tourism, extractive economies, failure and disappointment, and, not completely unimportant, costume. There are scores of anthologies of Western writing. Owen Wister's The Virginian is the prototype novel for the Old West, and Zane Grey, Louis L'Amour, Carl May, feeding the public appetite for more of the same. Wallace Stegner's Angle of Repose, Big Rock, Candy Mountain, Crossing to Safety, A.B. Guthrie's Big Sky, Larry McMurtry's dented image of the true blue decent cowboy with that fine novel HUD, Ivan Doig's The House of Sky, Walter Van Tilburg's fine novel Track of the Cat that moved away from the cowboy rancher to the hunter and emphasizes the mystical Indian who is uncannily aligned with the natural world. John Graves, Elmer Kelton, Jim Harrison, Tom McGuane, Rick Bass, William Kittredge, Mark Sprague, Molly Gloss, William Henderson, Richard Ford, and many, many more are writers of the West today. We don't think of Raymond Carter nor John Fante as Western writers, but I think perhaps we should. Perhaps the strongest writer linked to the West, if Texas is the West, now is Cormac McCarthy, whose interest in violence is intensely American. And there's Western naturalist literature, a whole discrete genre that owes a great deal to John Muir, Aldo Leopold, and Edward Abbey, though as a contemporary genre, it is usually personal, superficially observational, and sometimes over vague. More interesting to me are the invisible literary Wests, which include writing from and about Indians, Mexican Americans, Indian Hispanics or mestizos, the Chinese and Japanese. We had N. Scott Mamaday, who drew on his Kiowa heritage to write House Made of Dawn. And the late, great James Welch gave us real Indians, depressed, suicidal, and broken in two powerful novels, The Death of Jim Loney and Winter in the Blood, and Leslie Marmon Silko, who is also of mixed ancestry and called the first Native American woman novelist. I was pleased in this exhibition to see James Luna illustrating one mixed ancestry aspect of the West. Mexican-American writers are championed by Dagoberto Gil, a very good writer, one of the few I know who write about work, real work, and working-class people. Here is a truly neglected body of Western literature, including the work of Gil himself, Sandra Cisneros, Tomas Rivera, Genaro González, Christine Granados, Diana Lopez, Tony Diaz. The complex but invisible West applies to photography as well. The stunningly rich and broad exhibition that we're here to talk about could easily have been two, three, four times as large. For example, I was disappointed that there was nothing from Miguel Gandert, who works today making photographs of Indo-Hispano rituals. There is still a great deal for us to learn about the West. My own writing has focused on Wyoming, the emptiest state, a beautiful, rugged place where I suspect it is better to die quickly in an accident than linger into old age with broken body or heart. It was never my intention to be tagged as a regional writer, and I have written about New England, Newfoundland, Texas, and other places, but Wyoming has seized my interest for the past 14 years. My main concern has been to link stories to the landscape. Landscape, for me, is geography, geology, archaeology, agronomy, agriculture, the violent character of the atmosphere, black squirrels and wild oats, bulldozers. It is jet trails and barbed wire, government land, malpais, dry stream beds. It is politics, desert plant robbers, introduced species, abandoned vehicles, roads, ghost towns, nuclear test grounds, swamps. Mine tailings, bridges, dead dogs. I see some of the realities and try to write about them. Trained as an historian, I try and deal with cultural and social mores through stories, not as a corrective, but because I find certain situations interesting and think readers will as well. Quite a few of the stories are based on historical events. Writing well is a major concern, and I put a good deal of time into the crafting of a story. There's a balance point in a story that I'm always looking for and sometimes finding. Many Wyoming people have disliked my stories, just as many Newfoundland people did not care for the shipping news, because rural people love their places and they want to see them lavishly praised, not peopled with gritty, bad-behaving fictional types. A lady came up to me after a reading in Wyoming once and said, "My book club thinks you are dragging Wyoming's name through the mud." And then she asked me to sign her copy of Close Range.
I'd like to start off by saying thank you so much for your excellent presentations. It's really an honor to be here with all of you and for you to share your thoughts with me and with the rest of the audience. As I was listening to each of your presentations, it occurred to me something that I hadn't thought about before, is that all of you call the West your home, but yet your formative years were not in the West. And I'm curious to hear whether there were any books, films, TV shows, or photographs that have made an impression or that informed your idea of the West before you lived there. Perhaps, Annie, you would like to respond?
Not really. I was born in New England from a New England family that had been there since 1635, and my father's people from Quebec, who had been in Quebec since 1637. And so I was very much rooted in the Northeast, but at the same time wanted not to be there. I thought the ideal place for me to spend my life would be Japan. I liked Japan very much. I was there in my early 20s and felt very much at home and just like the place. And it was odd because there I was, a tall, gangly, awkward, white female, and but I felt good about the place. I ended up in Wyoming many, many years later after I started writing by accident. I had a character in a book called Postcards. And this character was making his way and having his adventures across the country. And because I don't want to make the mistake that John Steinbeck made when he wrote Grapes of Wrath, he wrote it about the part of Oklahoma that wasn't suffering from drought, and people there have never let him forget about it. He sat down with a road map. So his Grapes of Wrath thing was a road map. He just assumed all of Oklahoma was blasted. But the one lush part was where he sent all his, where he situated all his Hokies. So I was following the trail of my character, and I needed a place to stay somewhere in the West, and I wasn't too particular. And I tried to find some, you know, the country is dotted with writers and artists' retreats. And I found one in Wyoming, in Ucross, Wyoming, population 25, and that sounded good. So I went there and was very happy with the long sight lines and being able to walk for distances. Something about walking works out the tangles in a story. And I stayed for 14 years. How did I get into this? I'm sorry. What was the question?
Went West,
yeah, it was, so it was by accident. No, I had no preconceived notions, really. I mean, I'd seen lots of photographs and films and so forth, but I didn't carry much baggage with me. I came to it with a fairly blank mind, which was good.
Well, I'm a little different because I was 18 before I ever came to New York. Mm-hmm. So I was Dodge City, Kansas. You don't get much more west than that, even though it's a geographic center of the United States. Certainly it's cowboy past. And then I moved to Kansas City and then to San Diego. Went to high school there. So, Rudy Fuchs at the Stedelijk Museum, when I had my retrospective there, he wrote a thing for the catalog, and he said that he felt that the first time the landscape of America was ever really seen was in Easy Rider, because we'd never, I mean, you'd seen it in Monument Valley, you'd seen John Ford and so on, but no one had ever gone across the country because we had union problems, and we made it non-union, and the IA, the Teamsters, we couldn't have gone across the country. It would cost us... Forget it. So, you know, and this came out of Godard and Truffaut saying, you know, lock the people in their studios, go out in the street, the whole world is a sound stage, and so on. So, anyway, yeah. But I took a wonderful photograph in 61 of the West Side here in New York of kids playing stickball, and I couldn't find it, and I wanted to end it with what is really the West, because, you know, the real West Side story is in New York. And it depends on where you are, what's West. If I'm in England, everything over here is West. And, you know.
Well, it's something so. Certainly that Annie brought up, but Katie, you mentioned it as well, the idea of the many Wests, and I'm wondering maybe if you might elaborate on that since you mentioned it as well.
Yeah, I think there are so many, obviously, different experiences of the West, and I mean, in answer to sort of to your first question, in the Northeast, my cousins moved to California when I was very young, and they moved to San Jose, and I remember, you know, every winter in particular, they would call from San Jose, and they'd calling from paradise, and it's another sunny day in paradise, and, you know, we thought, gosh, why don't we move to California? Why aren't we living there, and why would we endure these winters? And they would send pictures of us, pictures of themselves to us, always seemed to be in the pool or by the pool. It just seemed so, you know, it seemed so lovely. And I remember at some point we finally went to visit them, and I thought, you know, this is paradise. Like, this is, you know, San Jose is hardly the way that they depicted it. It's just a sprawling suburb, and it was sort of anything but... paradise to me. So that was sort of my first impression, that kind of like, you know, the way that they were telling themselves stories or trying to perpetuate their own story as they needed to. And then, you know, my sort of experience with it being completely at odds with that. And so, again, of course, there's just vastly different experiences of the place. I mean, I think Annie touched on that very well. And Wyoming and California in some ways couldn't be any more different from one another.
But, you know, people always do that. They move out to where there's plenty of sunshine and so forth, and then they torture everyone behind by calling them up and saying things like another day in paradise. And they do that. Yeah, it's like putting on the costume. It's like converts. Converts to Westernism.
This sort of, I suppose, this idea between the myth or the artifice and the reality, I think in many ways, I know, Katie, you've dealt with it, and Annie, you touched on it a little bit, and I think Dennis, too, you know, this idea of a community of artists that sort of went against the grain that, you know, you were so intimately involved with, it seems like in all three of your work, there is this idea of a counterculture or a distinct identity or violence that really goes against the sort of perpetuated myth of the American West, and I'm wondering if any of you would care to respond or comment on that and how, you know, how much that really plays a role in your thinking of the development of the work.
I'm sorry, I lost the question.
Well, I suppose I'm sort of thinking about the idea of the myth of the West as
violence.
Well, the idea of the sort of rugged individual and the, you know, the sort of opportunity and the promise of the West as being one image of the West, but yet perhaps the reality is not exactly like that. And, you know, perhaps it's something that's more to do with failure or more to do with violence. And I wonder, you know, just be curious to hear whether there are any of you elaborate on that idea of sort of working against an established, preconceived idea of the West.
Yeah, but people don't choose to be failures and unhappy, at least not too many. So it's not a thing of choice. The thing of the dream and the expectation of success that guides them to this place is real enough. And, you know, when is the point where the people let go? A lot of Katie's photographs seem to invoke that question. When do you give up and say, it ain't working? Lots of people never do.
Yeah.
That's why the West has got people in it.
Do you like Frank Waters at all?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Man Who Killed the Deer?
Yeah.
He was an old friend of mine. He was the one. Did you ever meet him?
I never did, no.
He was such a great old character. He's a wonderful. He was like a Gary Cooper. I just think of him as a country gentleman.
Yeah.
And anyway. I was reading him the other day.
There's some good writing set in the West, and I don't know why in the world we don't have Easterns. It's just a phrase that never caught on. I don't know. Maybe there are writers here who think of themselves as Easterns, Eastern writers.
Well, the idea of you know, not thinking of yourself as a failure, or these characters not thinking of themselves as failure. There was a review of the exhibition in the New York Times, which was sort of looking at the exhibition as rather depressing, and sort of the end point really being you know, rather about failure. And Katie and I were talking that perhaps that wasn't the case, and we didn't read many of the photographs in that way. And I know that many of the people that you work with, Katie, you know, it's a real collaboration, and they're muses and inspiration for you, and mm-hmm. I wonder how you sort of think about the community of people that you work with.
Sure, I think I remember the sort of word that was used to describe a lot of the people photographed in the exhibition as pathetic, and I just thought, I don't see what you're seeing. You know, I don't. I thought, you know, they're maybe tough circumstances, but I think of them actually as sort of survivors, and the circumstances are tough. And there's a real distinction in that. And I think I always see a lot of actually dignity and the folks I photograph, and the fact that, I mean, there's a difference between working in West Hollywood and downtown LA, for instance. And I specifically didn't choose to photograph in downtown LA because there seemed, with a lot of the people I met, to be there seemed to be no hope, and really no, there was no spirit in a lot of the folks I encountered. And so when walking around West Hollywood, I found there to be still, you know, there was still a residue of stardust in a way. There was still an enthusiasm and an interest in engaging with me. And so there's a lot of spirit. And I thought, you know, that's often a reading of photographs of people who look anything but what, you know, the sort of, pictures we're used to on the covers of magazines or celebrity PR pictures or whatever, that anything but that has got to be downright, you know, pathetic or sad. And someone can be photographed and appear sort of wounded. There can be a psychological complexity in the work, but I think that kind of description is really, it's not the way I see.
It's actually not unlike rural people wishing to see their region or area described as exquisitely beautiful, you know, the Garrison Keillor thing where all the men are good looking and the women are strong or whatever. What is it he says? Yes, okay. That kind of thing. If it's your place, that's how you want it to be. And critics are not immune to this kind of thing. They probably would have liked to have seen, you know, something a bit what they would term as hopeful, or something of aspiration, something goal-oriented. They don't want reality. They want mythology. That's what the West is all about.
Is that a critique that you've received with your characters and your novels and stories?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But at the same time, I would say that the, you know, reality is, it changes. You know, it's not all, you know, one thing or the other. And it can be you're having a really awful day, or, you know, you things haven't worked out as planned, and yet the sun is still shining. And sometimes that is a really, you know, pretty good feeling. Other times it can feel really oppressive. So that, you know, it's sort of, it's not one thing or the other, but it's like life. It's kind of, you know, moves in and out of all those things.
Dennis, I was curious to ask you, when I was looking at all your photographs of, you know, some of these great personalities in the art world that you were, you know, lucky enough to be in a community with, and L.A. and the West Coast seems to go through cycles where the L.A. art scene is big again, and we're currently in one of those cycles. And I'm curious to hear whether you feel any affinity with the artists in L.A. now, or whether the community still is strong.
Well, I'm curating a little show up in Taos at the Harwood with six artists that I've known for over 45 years that I knew in Los Angeles that came to Taos. The Harwood is part of the University of New Mexico. He was a painter, and he left his studio to the state. But Kenny Price and Ron Cooper, Ron Davis, Larry Bell, Dean Stockwell, and myself. And we all moved to Taos more than 45 years ago. And Dave Hickey wrote a little thing about it for the – it's opening in May, at the beginning of May. And he said the interesting thing about these six artists is they didn't come to Taos looking – for something. They came to Taos already with their styles. So it wasn't, they came there to work, not to find their their style. I thought that was interesting. I have lost sight of the question. But
community of artists.
Well, for me, it was the only way. I mean, I didn't have any other way of doing things. That was, I didn't go skiing, and I didn't, I wasn't a ski bum or a tennis bum or whatever. I was a gallery bum, and I just hung around art galleries, and I wanted to meet the artists because I was an actor, and acting is an interpretive art, even though I consider it an art. It's interpreting someone else has written it, someone else is directing, and so on. So to be able to do a work that is only yours, that you don't have to involve 25 other, so many different departments and different things and different ideas and so on, was really a unique experience for me, and something that I wanted to find, seek those people out, those artists out, and the ones that I liked. I mean, I only photographed the ones I liked. I didn't photograph the ones I didn't. I wasn't running around photographing artists. And also when I get into Martin Luther King and walking with King from Selma to Montgomery and all that stuff, which is a whole other, and the hippies in Haight-Ashbury and all the different places that I was at that time are totally different things. But this was a community of people that I worked with and that I learned from, and figuring out that, first of all, New York had so much more of a communication center. I mean, New York's a communication capital of the free world, and like L.A. was a backwater. If you didn't come to New York, and I think there's an awful lot of really great artists that were in California and never came to New York, it's taken you a long time to be seen. Ed Riche came here. It was with Leo. And there are various ones that came with Leo, and they were positioned, and they were put into, like, really incredible positions. The others who stayed, like Bruce Conner and George Herms and Wallace Berman, who died very young, but they never really came to New York. They were never really transferred into New York. So it's just a different take on things. And the Pompidou finally had the big show at the Pompidou to recognize the West Coast artists. I think it was 1955 to 1985. And that was an incredible show. It was the first time we were really introduced to Europe, and that was just 2 years ago. So, I mean, things are happening, but I'm very happy about it. But I think there was really we really sort of didn't look. I mean, most people didn't look at the West Coast and look and see what was really going on there.
Well, and I think the idea of being a regional.
Ebenkorn, who I think is one of the great painters. Period.
Right.
We hardly see him in Europe. You hardly ever see him here.
Well, and I think the idea of being a regional artist or a regional writer, as Annie, you sort of touched on as well, is always a problematic one. And I'm curious now, Katie, that you live on the West Coast, how you feel, if you even feel like a West Coast artist, if
that
could be
said. No, I feel like a person, I feel like an East Coaster, in Berkeley, frankly. But I was just going to respond to what you said. I visited USC recently. I was so incredibly impressed by the faculty, by the students, by the level of discussion, the work that they were making. It was clear that they were, I think they found each other, this sort of intellectual small oasis in the city, and they're having nothing to do with sort of the entertainment industry whatsoever, but they seem very supportive of one another and excited about the fact that there's obviously a lot more support for the artists, for a lot of the artists working there. But I think that I found it to be, it was when I lived in New York, I always had to leave the city to be able to think or to make anything. And so when I moved to Berkeley, at first it was an enormous adjustment because all my best friends are here, but I was a lot more productive, and I continue to be a lot more productive and really constantly inspired. There's just not enough time actually to get all the things, to make all the stuff I want to make, and so I feel like I'm going to be there for a long time, and I don't particularly care if I I don't, hopefully I won't be considered a regional artist, but I don't worry too much about that kind of thing.
It's tricky for writers. A friend of mine in New Hampshire who wrote some, Ernie Hebert said one time, the kiss of death to be labeled a regional writer. And he's never really escaped it. I kind of find it funny to be labeled a Western writer because I've written about Vermont and Newfoundland and Texas and so forth. So I'm not writing about Wyoming anymore. not because I don't like the label of Western writer. It's still a bit of a joke to me. But simply because my interests have gone elsewhere. And I think as long as you do that, if you keep moving and let your mind fasten on different things, then the label will change, and after a while, people will be confused and leave you alone.
But yet, place is so important in your writing, and you talked about the idea of going somewhere to follow the character.
There are so many great places.
Yeah, of course,
there really are.
Can you maybe talk a little bit about New Mexico? Because I know you're very interested in spending more time there and what speaks to you about that.
I am. I'm something of an archaeology buff, and history is of great interest to me. I'm also interested in architecture, and certainly New Mexico has got some pretty fascinating and outrageous architecture, all the way from the old pueblos and Chaco and right up to the work of John Gaw Meem, who did the fantastic Zimmerman Library at the University of New Mexico. And some of the new modern architects working in New Mexico are fascinating. They're really fascinating. Using the ideas of plazas and the old architecture and thinking about it in new ways and what makes places hold together. So this interests me. I don't know how else to put it. And there are just, I'm a dedicated researcher, and there are many, 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 many boxes of interesting papers and so forth floating around in one place and another in New Mexico. So it turns me on. It's a yeasty, crazy, very wild mixture of ethnicities. Albuquerque in particular I like because there's no... I also like Magdalena. Gritty places, both of them, but there's no separation really in Albuquerque of high class areas and low persons. A cop who moved from New York to Albuquerque was talking to me one day, and he told me that one of the things that fascinated him about it is somebody with pots of money can settle in right next to somebody with absolutely none but 11 yapping dogs. And somehow or other it all works. So I like that. I like that mix of stuff. It's not like Wyoming at all. And Wyoming is a very, very beautiful place. And I had many happy years there, but I'm ready for a city.
Actually, unfortunately, we're soon running out of time, and I thought perhaps I would give the audience an opportunity to ask one or two questions if there are any. Hard to see.
And we have microphones down the aisle, so just raise your hand.
Can we maybe turn the lights on in the auditorium so we can see?
Yeah, it's very difficult to see the audience. No questions at all. Oh, there we go, a brave soul.
Do any of you have part of this exhibition, and have you seen the exhibition, and what do you think of it? It's a new one. I haven't seen it myself, but I was talking with someone before this began, and I'm eager to see it when I get a chance.
They have art in it. I don't have any images, but I did see it this afternoon, and it's very large in scope, and it deserves careful examination. You'll learn a lot about the West. Wests. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought it was, you know, very comprehensive. I agree. There could have been many, many, many more photographs. And I actually thought that it sort of showed a wide range of experiences of the West.
Yes, that's so. Why I really loved it, because it did give you many Wests.
Yeah, I agree. It gave you a lot of looks.
You can be critical.
I like the idea of the disintegration or the wasteland. Whoops. Hello. Yeah, I like the. Well, there's one right here. The building and the house, the car that's slidden down into the. It just looks like everything's sort of, a lot of it is like in California. It seems very new and not well thought out and is already falling into whatever.
I think like any exhibition, you know, you can always think of people that are missing, you know, who, you know, have worked in the West for quite a long time. Like, you know, Vicky Samuneris has worked there for a lot longer than I have. And I thought, where are her pictures in this? Or, you know, where are... the photographs that you're mentioning, yeah. There's always someone that you could wish had been included. So that would be my...
You'll have to do it again.
Yeah, you'll have to.
If I had bigger galleries.
Yeah.
Right. No, absolutely. You know, anytime you do a show of the scope in terms of the historical scope as well as just the number of types of pictures, there's always... you know, things that could have been included, yeah. That I wish could have been included.
Sure.
Any other questions?
I just had a question for Dennis. I was curious which movies you felt best captured some of the themes that we've been talking about the West.
So many.
Well... Grapes of Wrath got blown out of the water, man. I don't know where to go from there. Yeah. It was in Dodge City, Kansas. I don't know. I think that probably Haskell Wexler's Hal Ashby's... I think it was Woody Guthrie, wasn't it? That had the dust storms and the song. You know, movies are like the movies that we did in the early days. Basically, were done in the studio. So everything was created. There were backdrops and so on, and cars were shook, and like you had. So it wasn't. We weren't really out in the elements doing it. It was all prefabricated inside the studio. Until Easy Rider, very honestly, no one could go out. We couldn't afford to go out because the Teamsters is just too expensive. And they'd figured out a way to isolate everybody in and build Spain and build France and build Italy and all in the back lots of Hollywood. So, I mean, recently, of course, we've had a lot of films that have gone out and photographed the interior of the United States and so on. But, like, you know, I mean, film is a wonderful thing. And the thing that I see, unfortunately, happening is that it's becoming too Americanized. I mean, countries are losing their identities. I mean, De Sica and Rossellini and Fellini and all these kind of people. I mean, it was about Italy. It was about things. The French directors, the Swedish director, Bergman, Kurosawa, so on. Everything's looking like a big American action movie, which is really really a tragedy to me. And countries are losing their identities, and I don't know. Anyway, maybe that'll all change now that we're having a little problem. But, I don't have much of an answer to that.
Actually, I'm curious to ask, since we're on the subject of film, Annie, two of your books were adapted into films, and I'm wondering if how you saw the translation of your stories in the film format and how that felt.
Well, I was never under the illusion that it would be the story as written that appeared on the screen. And, of course, it wasn't. The shipping news was okay, but it was, you know, it wasn't the story. You can't crunch a whole novel into a film and have it be the same. Something has to go, and I was well aware of that. And that's why I think short stories probably deserve more attention from the film industry, because it gives the screenwriter a chance to enlarge and to work with the original material instead of what is essentially a destructive act of cutting and slicing and condensing and clicheing a longer piece. So that kind of thing, I thought, opened up big possibilities. I was, because I knew Larry McMurtry, or I never would have allowed a film to be made of Brokeback Mountain. But I knew Larry, and I knew that he had a respect for history, and he had a gay uncle at one time, so he had some feeling for the situation. And I think Diana Ossana was very vigorous in pushing him toward doing this. Anyway, I thought it was too sentimental. I fought hard to keep the language, and I was told again and again, well, nobody will understand what they're saying. People don't talk like that in the movie viewer world and so forth. We really have to change it. But if people can read the story and understand it, why can't they hear it? So that was about my only contribution. I didn't go to the set. I didn't bother anybody. It was just a question of language, and I did see an early form of the script and had some squawks about that. So that was the situation. It was made, and it worked for a lot of people, and it didn't work for another lot of people. I went to the rodeo Saturday night with my son and his girlfriend in Albuquerque, and a couple of the clowns were horsing around, and the announcer goes, "Oh, that ain't no Brokeback. We better watch what you're doing." You know, so this is a group that sure didn't like it very much. So they've managed to turn it into a kind of a ha-ha situation. I'm actually working now on the opera. So, which is kind of interesting and very, very radically different. Not an Italian style kind of thing, but a very modernist, difficult composer. So we'll see what happens. Charles Ronan.
The problem we always have with novels is you can't in movies go into the internal world. And in writing, you can go into the internal world of what people are thinking. We can't really do that unless we get into narration, which is, you know, defeats the purpose of film, really. So that makes a big problem when you're going from a novel into only an external viewing of a person. But I think the short story idea is perfect. I mean, it should, because it makes it at least in a size that you don't have to drop so much
right.
material, which
and
is just
just think it would
criminal.
Be more attractive creatively to the film industry to work with something and enlarge instead of slice and dice.
Well, I came in from Taos yesterday. I drove to Albuquerque. I flew to Dallas, and I came in last night. Mm. I'm going back tomorrow morning to Taos. I rode to Albuquerque, then to Taos.
Right. Well,
my
I did the same thing yesterday.
Only
I already started from Albuquerque.
I think we have another question.
This question is for any of you. It seems like in a lot of the early photographs of the West, a lot of it is about landscape and just kind of huge vast landscape, so when there are people in it, they're kind of dwarfed by that.
Yeah.
I mean, notwithstanding the fact that there are obviously so many more people in the West today, is that sort of imposingness of the landscape less important to the West now than it was?
Have you yourself spent time in the West?
Yeah, I'm actually right here. I'm from Oregon, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Land, lots of land with this kind of.
I mean, you could drive for 3 hours and not pass another person. If you know.
Are you from East West or Texas? West Oregon?
I grew up in Portland.
So. Oh, Portland.
Well, Eastern Oregon is pretty Western. But, yeah. I don't know what to say.
To me, there's no doubt. I mean, the landscape affects everything. It's the reason, you know, first of all, the reason you probably move there, the sun, the beauty, the, you know, undeniable beauty of the place. And but again, you know, California, the coast is so incredibly different than a place like West Texas, if, you know, you do consider that. Mm-hmm. The West, it's just, you know, hours and hours of ranch land, of arid ranch land. It's totally completely different experience. But I think the earlier photographs you were referring to, is just like the experience of discovering that land. I mean, and there were no people at the time, so or very few, certainly. And so the pictures have to be different, because now it's a different story. There's a different story to tell, you know, which includes a lot of development and, you know, and on and on and on. But I think the landscape is still, you know, crucial.
It's big. It's really big. And there was already in this country, and by mid-19th century, a passion for the panorama. And Ava, I think, should speak to that, because there's evidence of the panoramic view all through this exhibit.
I was very impressed with that, too.
Mm.
Yeah. And that went to Buffalo Bill and his whole circus.
That's true.
And Pawnee Bill. Wow.
And those, you know, the sweeping vistas of the West were suited to the panoramic format.
Yes.
And, you know, I think now a panorama would feel very different. You couldn't have that expanse. But I still think that the landscape is very important in contemporary artists who are working in the West. And, I think, Katie, actually, you're a good example of that. When you showed your East Coast pictures, they were indoors or, as mm-hmm. you were saying, behind bushes. Mm-hmm. And then you move out West and they're on the beach and they're outside. And, you know, there's a sense of it's important to be outside.
Sure.
And I was, you know, struck by that difference.
Mm-hmm.
People did, too, to show the West when it was first being invaded by Easterners. To show it at all, you had to come up with some large work. And what people did was take daguerreotypes of little pieces and then use them as the reference material to make the paintings of these enormous cycloramas that just extended for, I guess some of them were 2 or 3 miles long, and audiences would come to view them, and it would unroll, and you'd see the panorama of going up the Mississippi, and then the night show, they'd have to reel it back the other way, and they'd go down the Mississippi. But there was, for years, map collectors have been very puzzled by a dotted line on an early map of the West, and the little dot is the dots show someone named Jones crossing the Red Desert in Wyoming. That's in the Great Basin, very, very formidable, disagreeable country. And I have spent the last 4 or 5 years working on a book on the Red Desert of Wyoming, which is a big chunk of the state, 6,000 to 9,000 square miles, full of nobody knows what. But I always wondered about Jones. Who was Jones? And Carl Wheat, if any of you here collect maps, you know Carl Wheat's 7-volume set of explanations of what map originated where and when. Carl Wheat had no clue who Jones was and wrote in a note that I don't know who Jones was. But Martha Sandweiss, is it Martha or Marcia?
Well, she goes by Marty.
Okay, well, she knows who Jones is. And, Jones was a daguerreotypist who had in mind that he would show the immigrant trail all the way from, I think he started out in one of the Great Lakes states, all the way to California. And off he went with his daguerreotypes, and supposedly he made 1,500 of them, made a fantastic cyclorama of it, the big painting later. The daguerreotypes have disappeared. Cycloramas disappeared. And fortunately we have Sandrice's research, so now we know about Jones. But this thing, this ability to see the West, to make the journey, and they all said this is the safe journey, this is the real journey, this is how it is. People got in the habit of looking at these long, strung-out views and making a journey through it. So I think that shows up in this exhibition big time, that eye that's been trained by the panoramas and cycloramas. It's there.
There is one in Atlanta, the burning of Atlanta.
Where's
the Battle of Atlanta, Atlanta, Georgia.
It's
there's
there
a huge
now?
One, yeah. It's massive.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah, no, it's incredible because I'd never seen one before. Yeah. It just blew my mind.
Yeah. Every now and then you hear about one being exhumed from some town hall attic or something or other, but I guess most of them just have disappeared. Yeah. But they've left their imprint on our minds.
So I think perhaps we have time for one more question.
Hi. I'm curious about the idea of moving west, and is failure more of an option in the West than it is here? Because people move to the West to start new, and you never really hear of people moving east to start new.
No,
you never
you don't.
Hear of them again.
I know Westerners who've moved east. They come for a while. You know, they look at New England, they look at New York, and they go back home for several reasons. One of the things that disturbs them very much are trees. There are things in the way. You can't see 150 miles in the east. And so this makes them nervous. The other thing is that the levels of job expectancy, the demands made on your knowledge and skills are higher in the East than they are in the West. So people do fail when they come East. It's not only trees, but it's hard. People are talking faster, they're walking faster, they're thinking faster. You're going home where it's comfortable. And I have seen this happen many, many times.
Well, I want to thank the three of you very much for your insights and your time and your thoughts. It's really been an honor to be here with all of you. And I want to thank all of you for coming. Good night.